Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the next edition of the Patika Wealth Management Group call series. My name is James Patika, and I'm joined by John Patika Sr., who is the portfolio manager on our team, Patika Wealth Management Group here in Clearwater, Florida. And our guest today is Jonathan Woloshin, who is the real estate and lodging analyst for UBS Global Wealth Management's Chief Investment Office. Jonathan has over 40 years of industry experience covering virtually every equity sector over the course of his career, and he's been widely quoted in various real estate publications as well as national media outlets, including the Wall Street Journal, Barron's, New York Times, Bloomberg, and Forbes. And you may have actually seen him on TV on CNBC, Bloomberg TV, Yahoo Finance TV, where he's been discussing various aspects of the U.S. real estate sector. And we're really happy to have him join us on the call today. So with that, Jonathan, I'll welcome you to our call.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to it.
Yeah, Jonathan, this is John Sr. I like always to read what you say, and I'll listen to you when I see. I like the idea that over the last 40 years, you've covered all those industries as an analyst. A lot of these guys pigeonhole themselves into one. I like where you can really call on that experience when we ask you questions. So let's get started. The first thing I'd like you to do is to start by defining commercial real estate. Most people just think it's office buildings. So why don't you lay the groundwork here?
Yeah, that's a really great place to start, John. And you know, I want to go back to March of 23 when we had the, call it the mini banking crisis. And it was a pretty serious situation. And I was clearly getting a lot of calls. And the calls I was getting was, what do you think of commercial real estate now? And then people would follow up with, and while you're answering that, why don't you tell me about your thoughts on multifamily and industrial and shopping centers, so forth and so on. And I was scratching my head and I said, it's all commercial real estate. But that said something important to me. So, you know, what I would say is office is certainly an important component of commercial real estate, but by our calculations, office represents about 14%, 14% of the gross commercial real estate value in the United States. So when we think of commercial real estate, there's, you know, your traditional, you know, office and apartment buildings and shopping centers and self-storage. But there are other maybe less traditional ones, whether it's lab space, medical office buildings, data centers, wireless towers. There's a lot within the commercial real estate bucket.
Jonathan, so with all of that, what sectors should we be looking at right now within the commercial real estate? What do you think?
The first thing I want to say is that commercial real estate is a long-duration asset. And if one is going to invest in it, and I do believe for those investors who have a longer-term horizon and can withstand some illiquidity, I think there are a number of really attractive property types right now. Two that jump off the page at me that have been under pressure the last couple of years are both the multifamily, which is also the apartment business, interchangeable, and the other one is the industrial slash warehouse business. Now, both of these businesses have very good demand fundamentals. The issue and why they've been under pressure in the last couple of years has been this surfeit of new supply. That has weighed on rent growth. It's unarguable. But the good news is if you look at the new supply trends over the last, you know, probably at this point coming up on 2 years, new supply has been dwindling and dwindling dramatically. The new housing starts numbers came out today, and we can see the numbers in multifamily that new supply continues to come down. Now, there are certain markets that are going to still have oversupply for probably the next 2 to 3 to 4 quarters, but the fundamentals, especially from the demand side of the equation, remain very positive for us. You know, I mentioned shopping centers, particularly grocery-anchored shopping centers. If you go back to when e-commerce really first started, and I'm a big believer in e-commerce, by the way, the conventional wisdom was brick-and-mortar retail is dead. I didn't believe it then, and I think the numbers have borne out why no one should believe it now. Is e-commerce important? And does it continue to grow? The answer is absolutely yes. But if you take out automotive and gasoline sales, which I think is the right way to look at it, e-commerce is give or take 16% of retail sales. That leaves an awful lot of sales in traditional brick and mortar locations. But I think the more important point to me is, or two important points. Number one, there's been very, very little new construction of retail, whether it's shopping centers, whether it's malls, since 2016. And number two, that there's a phenomenon called omnichannel, which very simply means you as a consumer are sort of indifferent whether you buy online or buy in store, because you can buy it on store, you can buy it online, pick up in store, you can buy it in store, return it in store. So the point is, the brick and mortar retail location is sort of the hub for both e-commerce and traditional commerce. And so we think that's a really attractive sector. Some more non-traditional ones, data centers. I mean, we've all heard about data centers, but you know, the growth in data consumption, and this was before AI or artificial intelligence became a household word, was growing like a weed. Now it's growing like a lot of weeds. And the other one is wireless towers. It's an area that we like a lot because it's a great business with high barriers to entry, and it's a very, very steady cash flow business. So those are some of the areas in commercial real estate we like a lot.
I'm really interested in the data centers. I don't know if you can expand on what you just said or if you'd like to leave it at that, but the data centers is where all the action comes, all the comments. Seems like the money's pouring into it. Any other thoughts on that?
I had a conversation with an investor yesterday who wanted to get in the data center business. And the one thing I will say is, I mean, commercial real estate's a big asset class, but if you look at the hundreds of billions of dollars that are going into data centers, it is clearly an institutional game. I think back to, in a way, the growth of technology in the late 90s. We were sitting there trying to figure out who was going to win the dot-com game, if you will. And it was very hard to figure out. But our view was invest in the arms suppliers because they're all going to need the equipment. So I'm not sure, and I don't know if anybody's sure, who's going to win the AI game. But we know one thing for sure, they're all going to need data centers. And so for those investors who maybe don't have the capital availability to actually invest directly in data centers, and like I said, it's pretty much an institutional game, whether it's buying publicly traded companies or investing in private funds that put money in data centers, that's a really attractive way in our view to play it. Again, but the one thing I would say is, if you're going to go the private route, liquidity needs not to be an issue for you as an investor.
Yeah, the industry and a lot of people got really stung in 2008 and 2009. There's not a dead bubble out there. You don't see anything that looks like that to you, do you, in the commercial side?
If I compare the period of leading up to 2008, 2009, and where we are today, there are some similarities and some very important differences. And I think the similarities are there was a fair amount of commercial real estate debt, about $3.5 trillion back then, and there's a lot more now. It's about $5.9 trillion. The banks were big lenders to commercial real estate as they are now. But I think some of the really key differences are, if you look at 08, 09, that was really a banking and a credit availability crisis. And while I want to be clear, there are going to be debt defaults. So at that $5.9 trillion, we've seen some and we're going to see more. But in our view, is this something that's going to break the banking system? We think the answer is no. And one of the key reasons is the capital markets are open as compared to 08, 09 when they were completely shut. If you look at the commercial mortgage-backed securities market, CMBS for short, in 2024, there was three times the amount of CMBS issued that was issued in 2023. If you look at the unsecured debt market, which is really more oriented towards investment-grade companies, the public REITs have been able to almost unfettered issue debt in that market. Banks have gotten more conservative, unarguably, but if you look at the lending survey that comes out of Federal Reserve every quarter, and we just updated these numbers, the vast majority of banks have eased their lending standards. Now, not eased them to a point of we're going to like be making foolish loans. But I think this is one of the key differences. And the last thing I would say is, if you look at both the quality of balance sheets of public REITs and large private owners of commercial real estate, those balance sheets are in much better shape. So I don't want to say we're looking at a debt bubble that's going to burst. Are there going to be challenges and debt defaults and bad headlines? The answer is yes. But do we think that we've sort of ring-fenced that and we're not staring down the barrel of the same situation? Yes, I would say that.
Let's change up a little bit and talk about rates. We have a new administration that's in there. I know it's really early, but I'm going to put you on a spot. How do you see this playing out with mortgage rates and so forth?
Sure. So there are a couple things here. So when we talk about mortgage rates, let's say we're talking about the 30-year fixed rate mortgage. So there's a couple of issues here. So if we look historically, the spread between the 30-year fixed rate mortgage and the 10-year treasury rate has been about 1.75 percentage points or 175 basis points. That spread is significantly wider now. Now, it's not as wide as it got. It got up to almost 350 basis points. It's about 230 basis points today. And so that spread is wider for a number of reasons. One, just the volatility in rates. Number two, the Federal Reserve has actually been active sellers of mortgage-backed securities. Banks have not been active buyers. There are some other reasons I won't bore the audience with. So when I talk about the volatility of rates, this is one of the challenges the new administration has brought in. And, my comments are not political. They're just purely policy here. And so the current administration operates very, very differently from the prior administration. It's a little more shoot from the hip. It's a lot of policy by tweet. It's a lot of tariffs are on today. They're off tomorrow. They could be on next month. And so I think all that says to us, and we have to separate what the Federal Reserve is doing at the short end of the curve. And we think the Fed is going to take its time in raising the short end of the curve. But what really impacts real estate, be it residential, commercial, is what's going on at the longer end of the curve when we focus on the 10-year treasury. We think, although our fixed income team still does believe that we're sitting here roughly at a 450 10-year today, we think we'll end 2025 towards the lower end of four, whether it's four, whether it's four and a quarter, to be determined. But we think there's going to be a lot of volatility in rates. And given the uncertainty about how the current administration is going to move forward, with tariffs, among other things, if they do put in place significant tariffs, that has the ability to be inflationary and that will keep rates higher. So, I think the key for us as real estate analysts and investors is not as much the level of rates, it's the stability of rates. And if we can get a situation where, let's just pick 450, which is roughly where the 10-year is today, if we could know, are the 10-year's at 450, that takes a huge independent variable out of the valuation equation. And that's been one of the big issues in commercial real estate over the last couple of years. There's too many unknowns between what's the economic outlook, what's the rate outlook, what's my occupancy going to be, what's my rent going to be. When I talk to investors, they say, if I don't know my cost of capital, it's really hard to underwrite. So I think that's going to be really, really important. And since we do have 4 years of a Trump administration from 2016 to 2020, I think one thing we do know is he views his success as how does the stock market doing? Well, the stock market is going to do a heck of a lot better with more certainty about policy and rates. So it's a long-winded answer to a very important question. I think pinpointing rates in the near term is going to be a very, very challenging situation. But if we are correct, and I am correct, that ultimately President Trump is going to view the performance of the market as an arbiter of his success, that we think ultimately we're going to see more stability there. And that will ultimately be positive for both commercial and residential real estate, having that stability in rates.
Jonathan, I've talked to you before about single family homes, and you came out with some interesting numbers about the burn rate and all of those things. Can you talk about how many homes we need on a typical year and where we're at? Are we short homes and so forth? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and I'm sure that a lot of your listeners have read a lot of different stories about out there about how many housing units we're short in this country. And I've seen numbers anywhere from we're oversupplied to we're short 7 million units. I will tell you the work that I've done, I come up with somewhere around 2 million, give or take. And that's based on looking at demographic trends, home ownership rates, the trends on when people are buying homes, what the new supply of homes is, and very timely, the new housing starts numbers came out today, and the new starts were once again below a million. They were close to a million. And so let's put a million in context. During the housing boom period of kind of 2003 to mid-2007, the annual housing starts numbers were like 1.5, 1.6, 1.7 million, whereas the home ownership rate was pretty consistent until the peak of the housing bubble when it hit a little over 69%. It's been pretty consistent around 65. And so I guess the short answer is I don't think we're going back to those 1.4 million, 1.5 million, 1.6 million numbers anytime soon. One of the large home builders had an earnings call this morning. And so when I listen to all these calls and I triangulate all the data, I think we're going to be hanging out in this sort of single family housing start range of 1 million plus or minus a little bit for the foreseeable future. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, the home builders. A, the public home builders have gained a lot of share since the bursting of the housing bubble, and they are behaving very responsibly from a financial and operational perspective. So this housing shortage is going to continue to persist. Now, we have seen a significant increase in the amount of multifamily supply, but even that is starting to pull back, which is certainly a positive for owners and investors in multifamily. But from a single family perspective, I think unless and until something changes both at the federal level and the state and local level in terms of easing permitting, opening up more federal lands, and I mean, one thing none of them controls, rates coming down, I think we're going to see more modest housing starts, certainly compared to the go-go period of kind of 02, 03 through mid-07.
That brings to mind a lot of my clients, anybody who has a mortgage, I might say, they've got like 3% mortgages. They call it the golden handcuff. Any comments on that? Does that screw up the numbers? They're not selling when they can get over 4 in a money market and they're only paying 3 on their mortgage.
Yeah, and look, it's an absolute reality. I mean, if you look at the numbers, and so you've got round numbers, call it 87, 88 million single family homes in the country. 40% of those homes are mortgage free. And then if you break it down by the balance of those with a mortgage, about 21% have a rate 3% or less. Another 34% have a rate below 3 to 4%. And about 18% have a rate between 4 and 5. So if you're sitting here in a market with a 7.25 rate today, if you're sitting here, if you're one of those folks that's less than 4, it's a really heavy lift for you to say, I want to move up to a new home, which invariably will likely be more expensive, and I'm going to be putting on several hundred basis points more in rate. That's just going to be a really heavy lift. Now, I think one potential mitigant to that is homeowners are sitting on about $35 trillion in equity. That's a positive. But, you know, the realities are this, you know, whether you want to call it the golden handcuffs or the lock-in effect, I think is very, very real. And the other thing that is I find very interesting is people are aging in place longer. Now, I'm a big believer in the demand for senior housing. You can see it in the demographics. But if a generation ago, the average age of entrance into a senior housing facility was in the early to mid-70s, now it's in the early to mid-80s. And so I think this is a clear contributor to the lack of available for sale inventory. Now, you're seeing inventory loosen up in some markets, but in general, this is an absolute reality, and it's just going to take time for this to loosen up.
Just a couple more, Jonathan. I know you're always trained to not invest in your politics, but tariffs are unique to this. Not unique, but they're pretty strong on tariffs. How does that affect commercial real estate, or does it affect it at all?
Look, I mean, the short answer is yes, it would. And right after the election, I wrote a piece about the potential implications of a second Trump administration on real estate. And full disclosure, I asked more questions than I answered, only because there were a lot of unknowns. But you know, one of the questions I asked was, how much of the tariff talk is a negotiating tactic versus it's going to happen? And so, look, we're a month into the new administration. And so irrespective of the volatility and the angst that tariffs against Mexico and China, they're going to affect today. Oh, no, we'll delay them a month. The realities are the Chinese tariffs, the extra 10% are in place. But if the president moves forward with tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and Europe, I think the realities are it has to have a negative impact. Number one, I think it's clearly going to be inflationary. that's going to push long-term rates up, and it's going to be a negative. The other part, and you haven't brought this up, but it's an important point, is what happens with immigration and deportation. And again, you know, there's headlines and there's reality, but you have to ask the question, what does it mean in terms of access to labor? What does it mean for labor costs? And so, look, the short answer is, if there are tariffs, it means import costs are going to be higher, and all else being equal, that's going to be a negative, not only for real estate, I think it's being negative for the economy, because, you know, rising rates and lower GDP are just not a good thing. And so I think we have to go back to that question that I asked, how much of this is a negotiating tactic versus he's just hell-bent on, I'm going to put in tariffs because I think it's the right thing to do. And time is going to tell. And I think anybody who tells you they know is probably not being as honest as they could be.
Gotcha. Well, thank you, Jonathan. This is James again. We're getting close to the end of our time here. So what I'd like to do is just kind of throw it to you. Any last thoughts that you'd like to leave with our audience before we wrap up?
Sure. First of all, I want to say thank you again for having me. And I do want to offer to any of your clients and prospects, if they want to follow up, just let your team know, and I'm happy to do it. And this is what I'll say, and I say this not only as a real estate analyst, but as a private investor as well, that for those clients who have a longer time horizon and understand their near-term, mid-term, and long-term liquidity needs, that commercial real estate is a terrific investment. It has low correlation to the stock market on a risk-adjusted return basis. It is a solid ballast in a portfolio. Now, some investors are more focused on the income side. I tend to focus more on total return. So if income is more important to you, you know, obviously we can have that conversation. But just like when you have your conversations with your team about diversification, you know, whether it's stocks and bonds or what have you, the same thing applies to commercial real estate or investing in real estate. You want to be diversified by property type. You want to be diversified by geography. You know, there are some people who are comfortable investing in single asset deals. That brings on certain different levels of risk. So there is no one right answer. As I like to say, there's no right and there's no wrong. There's only what's right for each individual's circumstances. So when you think about it, and this is where, you know, having an advisor is so crucially important, to talk about things like your time horizon, your near-term, mid-term, and long-term liquidity needs, how comfortable are you with volatility, things like that. And the last thing I would say is, if you're going to invest with a third party, you want to invest with a very high-quality sponsor who has a long-term track record and has navigated multiple cycles. And I would stop there.
Great. Well, thank you, Jonathan. That was very insightful. And again, we really appreciate you joining us today. And if anyone listening has any questions on what we discussed or would like to receive more information on the U.S. real estate sector, please reach out to us and let us know. We're happy to share some of Jonathan's research with you. And please feel free to share and like this podcast and give it to any friends or family you think this might be of interest to. And with that, I'll say take care, everyone. And thank you again, Jonathan, for joining us.
Thanks, Jonathan.
My pleasure, and thanks for having me. Take care.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.